chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. I'm thrilled to have Justin Henshaw on the show today. Justin is the founder and CEO of Gage and the owner of Henshaw Companies. Well, Justin, I am absolutely thrilled to have you on the Something Extra podcast today. Thank you so much for joining me all the way from St. Simons, Georgia.
That's right. St. Simons Island. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I mean, absolutely. Well, you know, you're just such a force for good. And I told you, you're big. There's a lot to you. Many, many facets to Justin Henshaw. And so, you know, I'm hoping that we can cover a lot of that today. But you know what? I have to do a shout out to our mutual friend, Jim Bechtold. And we've just had a little sidebar conversation about Jim and just what an amazing human being he is. What did you say that he's like a cheerleader?
You know, he, you know, sometimes God just throws people right in your life at the right time. And he's one of those people. Like, he's been just such a cheerleader for me and for the project I'm working on now. And just, you know, he really believes in it. He's been such a supporter. So thank you, Jim.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, he's a very, very special person. Well, I cannot wait, Justin, to dig into your story and introduce you to our listeners. So I do want to take me back to growing up. And I, of course, you're a native of St. Simons Island. You're a That's native. Right. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's some, you know, really difficult things in your story, but some beautiful things, too. So take me back to growing up.
Sure. I'm from pretty tough childhood, or at least a poverty stricken one. You know, we grew up pretty poor. My mother, when I was younger, struggled with drug and alcohol abuse and eventually depression. And she never really, you know, shook that. And she committed suicide when I was about 8 years old. And my grandmother, took custody of me and my sister. And she didn't have money either. She worked as a clerk at the hospital and as a cashier at our local Winn-Dixie grocery store, you know, and she took custody of me and my sister and raised us. She raised us, you know, with love, you know, not a whole lot of it else, but a lot of love. And so, you know, thanks to her, we grew up safe, and loved, which is, you know, which is awesome. And, I'm so grateful. Matter of fact, she lives with us, me and my wife now.
Does she? That's awesome. How old is she now, Justin?
89, I think. Yeah. Yeah, I should know that, but it's 89.
That's so special. That's so special. Well, you know, like you said, she worked two jobs. I mean, she was all in with you guys, right? And I kind of read something that you had written and I thought that was really funny. You said you were showered with love and you were incredibly spoiled, yes, but not with a lot of discipline. And
I can relate. It's really easy to do that as a grandparent. We have a 10-year-old grandson. And my husband spoils him rotten.
Yeah, you know, like she didn't have time to make sure that, you know, I did my homework, you know, and she didn't, you know, I, you know, she, you know, more or less just let me quit, you know, a lot of sports that I probably shouldn't have when I was a kid. And I didn't have a male figure in my life. I always joke around that my first father figure was my drill instructor in the Marine Corps. But I was raised by women. I was raised by my grandmother, my aunt who lived with us, you know, for most of our childhood, and then my sister, you know.
Yeah. That makes you a really good husband, though, because you understand women, which is really, really good. And we won't talk about that.
Real quick, can you just say that over?
That makes you a really good husband, Justin, because you understand women. So yes, you can write that down and give her that little clip. But you know, this is interesting to me. So when you were a young man, you moved to New York to pursue a career in acting, and you know, our son, our oldest son, Jordan, did the same thing. So, he left high school and went to LA, and not to New York, but went to LA and spent 5 years there, acting. So what was it for you? How did it go for you? I mean, why acting? Was there somebody in your life? Did you love a story? I mean, what was the precipice?
I guess, music was kind of the beginning for me. My grandmother, you know, encouraged me to, you know, be in band when I was, you know, a kid, and I learned a lot of instruments, you know. I was a big band geek in high school. I definitely wasn't one of the cool kids, but I loved arts and the performing arts, and then I got into theater and acting in high school, and I really loved that. I love the ability to just kind of become someone else and step into another role and feeling that out. I didn't have the grades, you know, I tried to get into some schools like, you know, Georgia, go Dogs. I would die to go to Georgia, but I couldn't because I didn't have the grades. And, you know, and I just really didn't know, I didn't have a lot of direction back then. I didn't know what I was going to do. And I had this opportunity actually that just led to New York. And I moved there. I actually, started out modeling, believe it or not. And that kind of, I used that as kind of like my gateway into acting. I did a lot of runway shows and stuff like that back in the day. Now this was a long time ago. Okay. So this was 60 pounds ago and two kids ago, but still, it was fun. But I, when I moved to New York, I obviously, that was my first experience anywhere. Like, I mean, I hadn't even lived, you know? So New York was a huge staging point, you know, in my life, and obviously led to everything else in dramatic.
Right. Yes. And we're going to get into that. Well, you know what, there's so many connection points here, that I did not know before we started talking, but, first of all, Jenny, my EA that you've met, that is amazing, was a theater major. And really? Yes, and she was in New York for a while, and she's got some fun stories. We'll have to send you a podcast that she and I did. And then Jordan, our son, he started modeling as well. That's how he started out. He was Next in New York. He was represented by Next in New York and did Abercrombie in New York and Ralph Lauren in Miami and Vogue in Paris, and that was kind of his entree too.
So back in the day, what happened was, in Jacksonville, there was, this small little agency that I started, working for, and, Tommy Hilfiger, you know, himself actually came into town. He was doing these PR events, going around to like Bloomingdale's and Macy's and signing autographs and stuff. And whenever he goes into town, he hires this entourage of like local models. And that's, that was kind of like the introduction. I met one of his people. They said, "Hey, you should come to New York. Maybe we'll get you some work." And that was enough for me. I worked it out back, saved some money, through a summer. And, you know, then I packed my bags and left.
Yeah.
So modeling was really, and my claim to fame, I did some extra work for like, you know, soap operas and stuff, but I really didn't get very far. To be honest with you, my claim to fame was 15 seconds in Sex and the City. Actually, that's probably.
Oh, well, cool. That is so cool. So I'm going to go Google Justin Henshaw, the actor.
I've already said.
Yeah.
One of the classic scenarios where I actually had a role. Like I had a speaking role. I told my family about it, told my friends, and got everybody excited. And they cut the scene. They literally.
Oh, no.
I actually found myself, you know, 20 years later buying the DVD and looking at deleted scenes to see if I can find it, but I couldn't.
Oh my goodness.
They literally cut it and you could see me for like 15 seconds. That's it. And yeah. So pretty embarrassing.
That is so funny. Well, we're more connected than I even knew actually in our stories, but you know, again, I mean, Justin, you know, even though that didn't quite work out, you had an event. You were in New York City when 9/11 happened, and yeah. You witnessed that, and something changed in you. Tell our listeners what you decided to do.
Well, I mean, I never really was a militant person, or I had none of my family, you know, were in the military. You know, frankly, my parents were, you know, not, let's just say not military driven. And I never really thought about it, never crossed my mind. And of course that morning kind of everything changed for me, but I was working as a personal trainer on the side, and I was literally working in a gym that morning, and I was going to leave. I was going to go to the studios where we were filming for Guiding Light at the time. I was leaving the gym, and I remember, you know, they had like the cardio studio all on one side, right? And so everybody's running, everybody's working out. And I remember this eerie feeling, like as I was walking out, everybody kind of stopped. Like everybody stopped running, stopped working out, and they just started staring up at the screens, like staring at the TV. And I went around and I saw what was going on. And that was, you know, back when just, hey, a plane hit the, you know, it was like, you know, we thought it was drunk, or we thought it was just like this random accident. Everybody remembers the first, you know, hour, you know, where everybody disappeared. So I left the gym, went to the studios. And by the time I got into the studios, the second plane had hit. And now these studios were actually very close to the UN building and that area. And so by that time, I think everybody knew what was going on. National Guard had kind of shut off that block, and we weren't really able to leave. We had to stay within the studios, and within these studios, you had principals and extras, you know, they don't mix, right? They don't mingle, you know, this principal, <Right. laughs> their rooms, right. And extras, you know, we're down there you know, but today they, you know, descended from on high to mingle with the commoners. And no, we all just got, we got into one room together. And I remember, like, if we can't leave, the executives and everybody, the staff, the crew, all got into like their conference room, and we just watched the news all day, you know. And that was when the Pentagon got hit, and it was very surreal. And then whenever we were permitted to leave, that was, you know, again, you know, something I'll never forget, because the streets were empty. You know, we were literally walking down the middle of Madison Avenue and Fifth Avenue, and you know, I'm just sorry, but it was like. It was just some weird.
Like surreal. It felt surreal, I'm sure.
You know, it was like out of a movie, you know, and I still remember like bars, like people were in these bars and, you know, of course, angry and screaming and shouting. And it was just kind of it was a strange moment. And I'd finally gotten in my apartment, and my apartment was at like kind of Inwood, which is above the Bronx, you know, and, you know, it was not much, but I had a terrace. I had like this, I was high up, and I had a terrace, and I had a view of all of, you know, south of Manhattan. And I could obviously see, you know, the smoke and everything. And, and I sat on that for about a week. And then, I went to Times Square and signed up for the Marine Corps. Now it was kind of back then. It's not like that now. But back then, the recruiting office was literally a like one office for all the branches, like in the center of Times Square, where all the branches were, you know, separated by these cubicles, you know, and like, so when you go in, it's like a cattle auction, you know, it's like, oh, come here, you know, and I remember I just wanted the Marine Corps. And so I went down there and signed up, and I was emotional and angry, and then that's it. That's the rest is history. And I guess a few years later, I went to boot camp.
Where'd you go?
Camp Paris Lejeune? Island.
Paris Island. Yeah. Dad was at Camp Lejeune.
Camp Lejeune was the, you know, that's the second Marine Division. That's the actual, you know, main base. But Paris Island is the boot camp, you know, if you're on the East Coast, and then West Coast, it's, I guess, Camp Pendleton. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's incredible, really. I mean, because something, a switch flipped in you, you know, Justin, because a lot of people witnessed that and they didn't go sign up to be a Marine, you know, but something flipped in you to say, you know, you love your country and patriotism was at an all-time high then.
There were those that did exactly what I did. Matter of fact, there was a lot of them. And you know, we even called ourselves like the 9/11 babies, because I remember when I signed up, like I was on a waiting list. Like, I mean, that's something you don't really.
Wow.
They literally put me on a waiting list to go to Paris Island. I wasn't able to go to Paris Island until like February, which was like 6 months later. Matter of fact, the day I stepped on the yellow footprints at Paris Island was the 6 month anniversary of 9/11. And I believe that's when they put the spotlights in the sky and so there were many of us and that joined, which is really unique because a lot of us were older than our NCOs and our, even our officers, you know, like, because we were in our 20s. I was 21. I had people that are older than me, never thought about joining the military. Matter of fact, my best friend in the Marine Corps, he was a chef at the Union Square Cafe in Manhattan. You know, these are people that were living their lives, doing their thing, never thought about joining. And they all did, you know, there was quite a few of us.
Yeah. Well, we could spend a lot of time on this, but I've got so much more things that I want to talk to you about. But my dad, you know, would always talk about just the discipline that he learned and the work ethic and the camaraderie and the teamwork. And it's we, not I. I mean, you know, all of those amazing lessons. But so you were honorably discharged in 2008, and you came back home and you decided to use the GI Bill to enroll in college at College of Coastal Georgia. And you were 28 years old. But it was funny because you said you kind of felt like you were 18. You felt like you were starting all over, you know, in college. Wow.
You did your research. Yeah, absolutely. That's something I say a lot. Yeah, I always say that because when I went to college, I started college, you know, that's when people are usually 18 years old, right? And I was 28. And it felt like there was just this 10-year gap. And it felt like I started over. You know, it felt like I was 28, but with a lifetime of experience, right? Like just New York and Marines and combat. But then I had to start over. Right. And so it felt like those 10 years, while it certainly made me who I was, it didn't really, you know, I couldn't put, Justin Henshaw, I'm really good with a K-bar on a resume. Right.
Yeah.
You know, so I didn't have sometimes when you go to the military, you learn a trade, right. You become,
yes,
something like that. But I was infantry, you know, so unless if you worked for the government or organized crime, you're kind of out of luck. So I had to go.
Sure. Yeah.
I had to go to college and use my GI Bill and try to make something of myself.
Mm-hmm. What do you believe that you learned from the college experience, just as you learned from the Marine Corps? What were those key learnings do you believe that college taught you?
Well, I think that again, without the discipline from the Marine Corps, it wouldn't have really worked because I was just not disciplined. I was just a completely different person. And I tried college like kind of right before New York. We kind of glanced over that part and it didn't work. But this time I was disciplined and I could see things through, you know. And
mm-hmm.
I still don't think I was a great student. I was too busy starting businesses in college. I joke around with my friends, you know, I was like, thanks for doing my homework all those years, you know, kind of stuff. And it's just, I really wasn't that. I was, you know, a B student, you know, nothing exceptional. But it was kind of like something I just, you know, I had the GI Bill and I wanted to see it through. But yeah, in college, I started two businesses.
I know. Islands of Sound, right, was one of those.
Yes, Island Sound was the first one, and that was my baby, and still kind of one of the largest, you know, companies that I own today. That they do really well. I DJ'd for weddings, you know, 10 years prior to that, like when I was in high school, and I wanted to supplement my GI Bill, you know, just have some extra income. So I started DJing these weddings and special events, and found out that I was really good at it, and found out that there was really good money in it. And I double booked myself and then I hired my best friend and then hired another friend and then Island Sound, you know, kind of took off.
Right. I mean, aren't you in 12 states or something like that now? Justin, yeah, that's crazy.
We're in between Michigan and Tampa, Florida, and all along the kind of the Eastern Seaboard. I think we're doing about 700, 800 weddings now. I'm very disconnected from the business.
Day to day. Sure.
Yeah, but I'm, you know, I have an awesome team and operator that soon to be managing partner that's running it, and he's killing it. So I think we're in between like 700 to 800 weddings a year right now. And we've more than just DJ, we do rentals and musicians and basically anything like lighting and stuff like that.
Right.
Events. Yeah.
Yeah. But then you mentioned you did start another one, and that was that Coasters.
That was Coasters.
That was Coasters, a food truck. Right. And which kind of catapulted you into the whole food and beverage world.
It did. It was, I always call it my education while I was getting an education. It was kind of like my lesson learned. Of course I went on to learn many lessons after that, but, it was, you know, it was fun. It was a class project, actually. I was in entrepreneurship class, and obviously that was speaking, you know, wildly to me because I just started Island Sound and it was doing well. And all my friends were like, "Hey man, this food truck is a really good idea." And back then food trucks were the craze. I mean, I don't know about now, but it was like, there was a show and there was a food truck wars and
yeah,
they were popping up all over the place, but they really weren't here, you know? Mm-hmm. So I said, you know, why not? And you know, I was making good money and so I did it. And for whatever it was worth, it was a lot of work. Obviously, you know, people say start a food truck, it's easy. It's not. it's wildly hard. And I just, you know, anyway, but we did burgers and fries, and we would do like kind of the late night scene, you know, like this is a high tourism area. So like the bar scene between, you know, like 10 PM and 3 AM where all the restaurants were closed, we did, you know, pretty well. But then that, you know, we closed that whenever the next, you know, opportunity came.
Sure. But you know what? I read something and I'm trying to think. I can't even give credit to it because I don't, it may have been Zig Ziglar. I'm not sure. But you know, there's not winning and losing, Justin. There's winning and learning.
That's right. That's right.
You know, and it's not failure if you learn something. And I know you learned a few things. One thing that you wrote that I love, you know, you kind of caught this idea of entrepreneurship and the ability to, you know, make money, you know, and you said you loved rubbing two dimes together and making a quarter. And I think that's really funny, but you know, it kind of started something in you, you know, and we've got a lot more to talk about, but we do need to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Justin Henshaw on the Something Extra podcast.
In business, the tendency is to seek out partners who are bigger, faster, stronger. When it comes to IT, you should be looking for smarter, faster, better. That's just what you'll find with the talented technologists at Technology Partners. Our experts develop custom solutions to tackle your most complex challenges, all to simplify your processes in the smartest, most efficient way possible. The time to be swift and nimble starts now. Go to technologypartners.net/solutions and see what's possible.
So welcome back, everyone, to the Something Extra podcast with Justin Henshaw. We have been having so much fun talking about a lot of different things that we just kind of left off. He really had a food truck that really kind of catapulted him into the food and beverage, and then he went on to do other things. So can you just touch on that briefly, what you did after Coasters, Justin?
Sure. Well, at the time there was a big trend for like these, you know, self-serve frozen yogurt shops. You know, I was a huge fan of that and that concept. We had a location that I thought would be perfect for it, and we found an investor who's still such a wonderful, you know, supporter of ours, just being a good local friend, and he's been such a supporter to the college and the community here. But we brought them on board and we opened up Fuse. So Fuse was our independent brand of a frozen yogurt shop, and it was very successful in the beginning. And now we have three of them, you know, and hopefully one day, you know, who knows? I mean, I'm kind of busy right now, but one day we might franchise that and grow it.
Yeah.
We love Fuse, and that definitely paved the way for, you know, really kind of a lot. Got into, you know, I wanted to maybe... At the time, I was really focused on franchising Fuse, but I still wanted to learn about the franchise experience. So I became a franchisee myself, got into a couple of Jimmy John's, a couple of Smoothie King's, a Salada Salad Kitchen, and kind of just really just learning, you know.
Right.
I love learning new concepts and learning and opening new stores. And that's kind of my passion, is just doing something new. They always, you know, say that I get bored really easily, which might be one of my downfalls, but, you know, that's just kind of like the next 10 years. We just went, we did three Fuses. We did two Jimmy John's, two Smoothie King's, Salada Salad Kitchen. We did an independent brand, but we ended up having to sell that one to focus on our Gauge, our project. Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that I thought about really, now you had the burger and fries, you know, with coasters, but one of the things I thought about is, you know, you were like a fitness instructor, you're a Marine. All of these brands, Justin, kind of have a healthy thread in them though, right? Smoothie King is, that's good. Jimmy John's is good quality food. And then the salads, you know, and stuff. So I don't know if you've, that was intentional or not, but.
Well, I will say that it spoke to the, you know, just freshness, right? I mean, you know, burgers and fries, obviously that's greasy and something different. But mm-hmm. like for me, I was trying to break into something I don't think was done very well here, or at least in the fast casual world, which is just fresh. You know, Salada was awesome and very popular. We ended up choosing a bad location for it, but it was still very popular. And I think it just spoke to just people want fresh, not always just greasy, right? Mm-hmm. Same thing can be said for Jimmy John's, right? I mean, it's a sub, so, you know, it will put the pounds on, but at the same time, it's fresh, you know, it's mm-hmm. very, they're known for their quality and their freshness, and at least it's not, you know, grease, right?
Yes, for sure. Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. Well, so today you are the CEO of Gauge, and we're going to talk about Gauge a lot, but you're also the CEO of Henshaw Companies, and that is your overall parent. And I think you've got 13 companies or something like that underneath. Maybe you've added a few more since, you know.
We're actually taking a few off. Yeah, we're actually – well, we're down. We're kind of divesting from some of our restaurants. We've gotten advice from, you know, investors when we got into Gauge, like, listen, you might need to clean up your plate a little bit, you know,
right.
And so we're focused on, you know, really narrowing it down to, you know, our you know, our independent brand like Fuse and Island Sound. That's not going to go anywhere, you know. Mm-hmm. I love Jimmy John's. I don't think it's going to go anywhere. But we'll, you know, we're actually actively selling Smoothie King's right now. To somebody that's actually my operator, which is a great story, but we can't get into that. You know, so we're divesting from a lot. We have real estate, in our portfolio, just a little bit here on the island, that, and just a few of those, and that way I can really focus on Gauge, you know, that's
right. And there's a lesson there, Justin, yeah. You know, cause you cannot boil the ocean and do well, right? I mean, narrowing the focus, having five things on your list, not 200, you know, is really the way to go. Well, here's, I want to camp out.
15 years to learn that, by the way, but I think
listen, we're still learning it. I mean, Greg and I, my husband and I co-founded our company 29 years ago. We're still learning that. I can get distracted by the shiny bobbly things a lot. And, you know, you just cannot have 200 things on your list and do them well, right? You just can't. So it's hard. It is hard because there's a lot of good things out there to do, but you want to choose the best. So I want to talk about Gauge, but first of all, you've built such a strong culture, mm-hmm. you know, at Henshaw. You have a favorite Bible verse that kind of informs and kind of is overarching for Gauge and Henshaw. What is that verse? And tell me what the verse is. I'm going to ask you a few questions about it.
Colossians 3:23, whatever you do, work at it with all your heart. And it's just this idea that, you know, we're, you know, the Bible says we're put on this planet to do three things, worship him, multiply, you know, love and have family, and then work. You know, mm-hmm. we are designed to work and have meaning and purpose, which is everything that's about Gauge, right? That is what Gauge is all about. And we'll not want to jump ahead, but yeah. So, I mean, it's this idea that I always told my team with Henshaw Companies that I believe that work is the most important word in our language. It's a 4-letter word, but it is incredible. And I even say that it's more important than love. I always say, like, there's a four-letter word. It's the most important word in our language. What is it? Mm-hmm. Everybody goes to love.
I said love.
No, work. Because real love takes work.
Mm-hmm.
It takes work. And all of the things that are valuable and incredible in our lives, if you look at them, they all take work. They were never given, because anything given was never valuable to anybody. It's because you work to achieve it that it means anything. Mm-hmm. And you can say that about your marriage, right? To try to telling of people that have been married for 20 years that it doesn't take work, right? Mm-hmm. You can say that about parenting and having kids. You can say it about your career, you know? And I really think that you could lay a lot of problems that we're having in our society right now at the feet of work ethic is dying, and people are losing the sense of meaning and purpose in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could not agree with you more. Yeah, work. I think you even say work is the salt of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you say that? Okay. Okay.
Without it, it really doesn't, you know, that you just think about it. I mean, how many stories do you hear about somebody that gets rich too quickly and then they ruin everything? Or, you know, like somebody that wins a lottery, you know, and dies of an overdose. You know, it's just like there's all these mm-hmm. examples that it really is because you work to achieve them that they mean anything to you. And that is really the true sense of joy in our world. And that is how we're designed, you know. I mean, again, you go back to, you know, Genesis 3, you know, God gave Adam a garden to work and to keep.
To work, right.
I mean, you know, God could have given him a couch and an Xbox, right? But he didn't, you know, he gave him a garden to have purpose. And this was before anything, right? I mean, so he knew that man needed purpose, that people needed meaning in this world. And
that's so good. That's so good. And I could not agree with you more, because I do think that a lot of people have lost that, you know, and they don't look at work that way. Justin, they're like, we're living for the weekend. It's like, you know, I got to hurry and get to the weekend, or hurry and get to retirement, you know. But Ken Blanchard was on my show last year, and that guy is so incredibly inspiring. He's like 84 years old or something like that now, still writing books. He's written over 60 books, you know, and he said, you know, a lot of people think, oh, you know, the best years are behind me. He said, I say the best years are yet to come. And he's still living with God. So he's still working. He was working on a book when he recorded the podcast. It's just, you know, I do believe you're right, though, that it does. It gives us joy. It gives us meaning. It gives us purpose. So I want to ask you this, because you refer to the employees at Henshaw. You refer to them as your family. And I want to ask you about this, because I read an article recently, and this gentleman was saying, stop referring to your workplace as family.
Have you
read that too? Yeah. And he's like, stop referring to them as family. They are a team. They're not a family. They're different. You know, but I mean, Greg and I co-founded Technology Partners 29 years ago. We refer them to them as our technology partners family. I mean, you know, we really do truly try to care for them as we would family, but we also have expectations and accountability, but that doesn't mean you don't care for them. So how do you think about that?
You know, I think it's, you know, to each his own. I mean, that's the environment that I love to create. I mean, I'm drawn to it. In fact, matter of fact, you know, my wife and I talk about this. We get too close, you know, sometimes to our employees and our team members, and we've been burned by that, you know, many times. So it does come back to bite us sometimes. But I think overall, it creates an atmosphere that we enjoy and that we want, right? You know, I've always felt that way. And I really can't, I understand the argument, you know, to like only call them team members or whatever. And certainly we are all about team members. And we do say, we don't say the word employee. We believe that employee is a class certificate, you know, classification, a tax classification, but not necessarily, you know, how you view somebody. So we always see team members. But I tell you what, over the years, you know, we've really gotten close. I mean, we have them over our house all the time. We do things together. We have bowling nights. We'll shut the stores down. we'll shut all of them down and go bowling, you know, and there's that's the culture. I mean, that, you know, it just goes into, you know, the Gage, you know, we built that together. Like, this wasn't just Justin that built Gage. It was basically, you know, all of Henshaw companies. And that's what, you know, really, you know, that's where it came from. We worked all over on Gage for the past, you know, many years, you know?
Yeah.
But it's, you know, I understand that argument. I've read that article, or I've read, you know, that viewpoint, and I get it. But I tell you what, this generation, you know, the days of collecting a paycheck and going home with no other engagement or feedback are over. You know, that is a generational thing where, like, my generation, our, you know, older generations, we got a paycheck, we showed up, we did our work, we got a paycheck. That was the transaction, right? That was it. But that doesn't work anymore. You know, that does not work anymore. This generation has evolved, and maybe rightfully so, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we older generations, we get crabby, like, you know, just take your paycheck and, you know, shut up, right? But I mean, I think that we've gotten to a place where we need more than that, you know? And when you have a Gallup poll that says that, you know, employee engagement has fell, you know, down to 30% of what it used to be, I mean, that's why we're experiencing, you know, the workforce issues that we're experiencing right now. There's no news is good news is not, we're cutting it anymore. You actually have to get involved and communicate and engage with them.
Yeah, I could not agree more. And, you know, I just think people, you know, there's an old adage that people don't care what you know until they know how much you care, you know, and I do believe care and compassion, just like what you would for a family. I think it goes a long way. You know, I've got a friend, Joel Manby. I don't know if you know that name or not. He was in Atlanta. And I know, you know, you're a little far from Atlanta there, at St. Simon Island, but he was the CEO for Hersh and Family Entertainment and then became the CEO for SeaWorld. He wrote the book Love Works, Justin.
Yeah, I know that one.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. It works. I mean, yeah. It does. Yeah. And, you know, I love that. Well,
Henshaw companies, I mean, I'm sorry, just last thing I'll jump into. Yeah. I cannot say that, like, you have to say that we did this as a team, right? What we have is, I'm not, you know, obviously I'm the quarterback, but I mean, it takes a team to build this. And you want a Zig Ziglar quote, it's, you know, you don't build a business, you build a team, and the team builds the business, right? And we believe that wholeheartedly. So, you know, my love for this workforce and, you know, this generation, you know, I've heard way too many, you know, negative things said about this generation. This generation is not bad. They are incredible. They, and this world that they, you know, were brought into, they didn't create it. We did, right? This instant gratification, you know, I got to have my pizza and I got to have it now. Well, that might work for, you know, delivery drivers and Ubers, but it doesn't work for career fulfillment and real meaningful relationships, right? I mean, that takes time. And, but this, they've just evolved and we need to evolve to catch up with them. You know, we need to give them the tools that they need.
Right. So perfect segue. You set me up, didn't you? So let's talk about Gage. And because, you know, you've seen this, you've spent time on this with employee engagement and that. So tell me about Gage. Tell me what you're doing with Gage. What is it meant to do? What are you excited about there?
You know, Gage is a game changer. You know, it's admittedly, it's a you know, shot for the fences. It's a way of changing. It's a disruptor meant to be so. And it's really quite simple. You know, the idea is that whenever somebody works, whenever somebody does something, right? You know, we talk about the paycheck, but they do more than that, right? They build and they create. They actually, they're working, you know, towards something. They're not just clocking in and clocking out anymore. They need meaning and purpose. And that's what all the studies show. And so how do you do that? How do you give them meaning and purpose, even in like entry-level positions? Because that's where it starts, right? Like from 15 to 27, you work at a restaurant or a coffee shop. And these entry-level positions are so very important. They are so very important because that's where you learned your soft skill development. And that's where you learn how to show up on time and have a schedule and accomplish things. They are so important to the foundation of who you become, that we need to do better at utilizing it. Right. Well, so giving meaning and purpose is like saying, hey, when somebody works, why don't you allow them to own the product of their work? So I use the example of the filing cabinet, right? Like right now, businesses uses a filing cabinet, whether it be a digital, you know, HR software platform or whatever, it's still a filing cabinet, meaning the business owns the data. So the employee gets evaluations, they get They get, you know, promotions, they get employee, you know, customer feedback, you know, reviews and stuff like that. All of it goes into a manila folder, into a filing cabinet, and it stays with the business. And that's why employees don't care about it, because it's not their property. It should be.
Mm-hmm.
It's not their property. They know that that manila folder is waiting for a shredder one day. And whenever they leave, so there are no consequences, good or bad, that whenever they leave, it's all disposable. It doesn't matter. So what we need to do is create a universal system, something that's something that they own, something that they can take with them, and say that, hey, this is who I am. This is the product of my work. This is what I'm capable of. And if you do that, and we have done it, we had our MVP that launched this past January, you see the light in their eyes. It comes on. It's like, wow, this is mine. This is mine. This is not the business's. This is mine. And then I get to take it and show it off to my next employer, and then my next one. And then I can build a tangible, real, proof of all the product of my work. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of, and the reason that it's so, it's never been done before. You know, it's something that, you know, really takes like, hold on, what now? You know, like you kind of have to really think about it. But then mm-hmm. once you think about it, you're like, how has no one done this before? Right. It's really quite simple. It's just, you know, different.
Mm-hmm. I'm really thinking it's more of a comprehensive view. It's really a comprehensive view of that person's life of work, you know?
Yeah. So the simple, really? The simple elevator pitch is this. It's like, Gauge is, a universal system for measuring performance within the workforce. It transfers from job to job, where an employee can own, and build a database of their work. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and we have a metric. So we've invented an employment score, which scares people at first, but once people understand how it works and the freedom and control that the employees have over it, it really is liberating, because we live in a world of metrics, right?
Yes.
I mean, so like if you, you know, we have throughout our entire lives, everything is attached to a metric, whether it be GPAs, grades, your blood pressure, your, you know, your weight, your bank account, you know, your credit score, you know, these are all metrics that guide us through our lives, because metrics show you where you are, show you where you were, and show you where you could be.
That's right.
And without metrics, you know, ask any athlete this, you know, what are you going to do without metrics? Without metrics, you can't grow. You mm-hmm. can't, or you can't see you, you know, which is the motivation behind it, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Drucker famously said, you cannot manage what you don't measure.
That's right. That's
right.
I mean,
how do you know? How do you know, you know, talking about trainers and, you know, fitness, what's your PR, right? What's your personal record? And you want to try to beat that the next time, you know? So
every business understands it. It's a KPI, right?
Mm-hmm,
like
what are you
going to achieve? What do you want? And if it's all disposable and meaningless and you can go from door to door to door to door without any traction, well, man, that is disheartening. That's discouraging. That doesn't inspire, you know? I have a wonderful, you know, story that we tell over and over again, because it's happened a couple times, and I hope it doesn't happen again. So in the beginning, we have an algorithm, right? A very, an awesome patent pending algorithm that actually, has to update every now and then, right? It will always evolve. There will always be new components. There will always be new weights. As we get more data, it's always going to learn and improve. And before we fixed it now, but before, in the very early stages, whenever we made an adjustment to the algorithm, the score has changed. And whenever the score has changed, now this thing means less than nothing. At the time, we would have like 800 users, right? And
mm-hmm.
It's not a thing yet, but boy, did we get blown up. Whenever there's scores, we would send an email like saying, hey, scores are going to shift. Don't worry. They all shift. So it's all relative, right? But boy, we were like, man, what happened? I was in the 800s. Like, what did I do? You know, like, what?
Right.
Then we get this emotional attachment to this number that does not matter, because that's mm-hmm. what we do as human beings. We love metrics. We love it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that feeling whenever you, you know, jump on a scale and you don't like what you see, you know, or maybe you do like what you see, but it's a very real experience.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Well, yeah. So what's next for Gage? I mean, where are you guys in the process right now? You have funding. I mean, how can our listeners engage with Gage?
Yeah, right. That was perfectly named, right? We are raising our seed round. We launched our MVP product in January and admittedly with minimal resources. And so we're hoping to close our seed round in Q4 this year. We're in diligence with a VC group out of Texas. I'm sure I won't name them, but I think you guys know them really well. And then we have an angel network out of Florida that is kind of circling the bait. So we're excited about that and very hopeful, God willing. But then raising our round and then get to Gen 2. So the beautiful part about our business model is that we are a B2B SaaS product right now. Mm-hmm. We're not. That's really kind of not our heart. We're actually a hybrid. So we need to build out more B2C components and features. We need more features for the employee, right? So we have incredible resumes, resume builders coming out. We have peer-to-peer connections, peer-to-peer referrals coming. A lot of incredible B2C features that's really going to help the organic growth, right?
Yeah.
So right now, a B2B product is sold by a business, you know, like a Salesforce going out there and, you know, selling to a business. But once we have the B2C components, we're excited because we already know, because we've surveyed and we've been working with this product and we've been talking to our employees and the even the other businesses that are in the system, they want that connection. You know, they would love a connection like that. So we're excited about that. That's kind of our next steps.
Well, listeners, stay tuned. Follow Dustin. You know, I think it's going to be a game changer. I really do, Dustin. It's going to be really fun to see. I'm going to ask you one more question, then I'm going to ask you something extra.
Okay.
I know that your faith is really important to you. Mm-hmm. You know, how, you know, does it inform your life? I mean, how does it inform the way you interact with your children, your wife, how does it inform your life? How does faith show up for you?
I always struggle with these questions because I always feel like I'm a far better business person than I am a Christian, and I want to make sure that Christ is always at the center of my life. And I know that I don't, right? I know that it should be more. But for me, my faith guides me because I couldn't do, you know, when you're starting out in business, you know, you could live off of ramen noodles and risk everything. And you don't care. Before family. Right. Kid, or you know, like something goes belly up, you know, fine, I like ramen, I love it, you know, let's just eat on, you know, as Dave Ramsey would say, red beans and rice, you know, like beans and rice. But you start having kids and you start having family and a mortgage and all this kind of stuff, and it becomes real, right? It becomes and starting any business, especially a tech startup, is so risky, you know, so I couldn't do, but I believe that, you know, God is guiding me, you know, down this path, mm-hmm. Particularly with Gage. I feel like Gage is a force for good that is going to do incredible things for this generation. And I believe that I'm called to do that. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to ask for proof because God proves it to me every day. It's just every time God opens a door and, you know, just something Jim Bechtold, let's go back to him. I mean, that is right. Someone has made so many connections, you know, for us. And if that's not proof, I don't know what it is. It's just every time I have doubt, you know, that my faith mm-hmm. brings me back. And that's the only way that I'm able to prove.
That's so good.
Otherwise, the fear would just eat me alive. You know, I wouldn't be able to move because I'd be so afraid.
Yeah. But you know that, you know, God has called you to the work. And so he will equip you to do the work that he's called you to do, right? I mean, that's what you rest in. Well, let me ask you this, Justin. This is called Something Extra. What do you believe is the something extra every leader needs?
Wow. You know, I'm going to go back to what you kind of alluded to in the very beginning, was that just this idea of there's no such thing as failure. You're just learning, right? Just this idea that it's okay to make mistakes. You know, it's okay to make mistakes and learn from them. I've met too many business owners that have, you know, I think failed just because they quit, you know, or just gave up, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like you haven't lost until you quit, right? You haven't failed until you really just right?
That's good.
And because otherwise it's just, you know, it's just time, you know, you just, you'll figure it out. Like you just keep at it, you know, you just keep at it. Mm-hmm. Rejoice when times are good, because they're not going to stay that way.
You know? Right. Knowing that up front is just, you know, it's, there's ebbs and flows, there's valleys and there's mountaintops, right? We all have them. So yeah, that's really good. And you know what? We say we love experimentation. Justice. Mm-hmm. We'll experiment with something, you know, yeah. We could stay here all day telling you the things that we experimented with that did not work. But yeah. Again, it's okay because you learn and you do better next time.
That's right. That's right. You know, it's just, it's so powerful too, because everybody gets so, and even I have to tell myself that, right? We have to remind ourselves of that every time we make a mistake. Mm-hmm. We just keep at it. I think business owners, entrepreneurs of, you know, of any industry could, you know, really, you know, be served well by knowing that and holding on to it.
Agreed. Well, this has been so much fun and I cannot wait to meet you face to face. I'm sure that's going to happen, whether it's in trust or whatever. Yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I appreciate you making the time to be on the show today, Justin.
Well, thank you so much for this opportunity and the support. I mean, just awesome. And you do so many incredible things. We didn't even get it. Anyway, I'm a huge fan. Okay. Let me just say that. Right. I'm a huge fan.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc. 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.